The Laura Murphy Show, Episode 16.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everybody, to this episode 16 of the Laura Murphy Show. I am one of your hosts, Bob Murphy, and with me, as usual, is Carlos. Carlos, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Bob.
Now, folks, Carlos and I both were talking before we started recording here, and we mentioned that we were up kind of early today, and we both had a lot of coffee, and we noticed everybody on social media is really annoying the more coffee you have. I don't know why that is, but we'll try to pare down our aggression. Unfortunately, we're talking about a very irritating topic, namely how governments use inflation to fleece the public. So we'll try our best, though, to be happy and chipper about the whole thing, even though it's a depressing, infuriating topic. So before we jump into that, though, let me just make an announcement. On June 2nd, 2016, right, so that is a Thursday, Carlos and I are going to be giving a presentation. It's sort of a breakfast meeting. It's going to be in the morning, aimed at business owners. Okay, so we're going to be talking about the use of IBC specifically for someone who owns a business, and that's going to be in Brentwood, Tennessee, which is a suburb outside of Nashville. So it's limited seating. The venue, you know, it's not a big place. It's a small breakfast meeting. So if you're interested in that, if you're in the Brentwood area and you're free the morning of June 2nd, and we're in the year 2016, go ahead and just contact us via the website, and we'll give you the details of how you RSVP and so forth. So what are we talking about this episode? This is now going to be part two. Last episode, episode 15 of the Laura Murphy Show, we went through, Carlos took the lead and explained how it was historically back when people actually used money, that coins that had gold or silver in them, so actual commodity money, how it was that political authorities would debase the currency as a means of getting extra revenue. So specifically, we just talked about Caesar as the epitome of this. Caesar wants to spend a bunch of money. He can't raise it all through explicit taxation or even borrowing because just the public wouldn't stand for that. So how does he make up the shortfall? He debases the currency. Namely, he gets a bunch of, let's say, 1,000 gold coins. He melts them down, adds in baser metal, you know, a metal that's not as precious as gold. That increases the volume of the liquid he has. Then he remints coins. Let's say now he remints 1,100 coins total. And so what does that mean? Of course, that the gold content per coin is lower than it was originally. He goes into the marketplace and spends those, or he hires his soldiers, and then they're walking around town with coins in their pocket that don't have as much gold as was originally the case. And so what's the obvious effect of that? Prices in the marketplace, quoted in terms of coins, go up, because now people realize, merchants realize, they're not getting as much gold per coin as they were before. So that's an obvious example historically to show how this process works, that when governments debase the money, it gives them more purchasing power in the short term, but then when the community responds to it, prices in general rise. And so you see how inflating the money supply ends up leading to a rise in prices, and we hit on that distinction, that nowadays when people use the word inflation, they probably mean a rise in prices, whereas historically a lot of economists used the term to focus on inflating the quantity of money or credit. And so, you know, the two are obviously related. Other things equal, if the money supply increases, prices go up. But it was important, we thought, to make that distinction. Ludwig von Mises used to make it a lot, because in Mises' view, if you just looked at rising prices and thought that's what inflation was, then you'd be looking at the symptoms, and it'd be hard for you to diagnose the problem and understand what the actual cause was. So let me stop there. And Carlos, if you want to chime in talking about what we did last episode before we move on to today's new material.
Okay, well, one thing that we definitely need to do is to find a good way to segue from the debasing of the money the way Caesar did it to modern times. So somehow we've got to fast forward into today. And the main thing I would say to our listeners, because I'm a little timid about entering into this particular podcast, because I get fearful that our listeners will lose track of the explanation, because it really is complex, you know. The whole mystery behind all this is hard to decipher, and we mentioned that the last time. And I'm wondering if the best way to maybe launch into this is to pull a couple of sentences from a publication that was written in 1994 by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, which actually hits on the idea of the mystery that's involved here. And it starts out by saying that, quote, money is such a routine part of everyday living that its existence and acceptance ordinarily are taken for granted. A user may sense that money must come into being either automatically as a result of economic activity or as an outgrowth of some government operation. But just how this happens all too often remains a mystery. End of quote. Now here's another one, again from this publication put out by the Federal Reserve of Chicago. It says, quote, the major control of changes in the quantity of money rest with the central bank. The actual process of money creation takes place primarily in commercial banks. So banks can build up deposits by increasing loans and investments. This unique attribute of the banking business was discovered many centuries ago. It started with the goldsmiths. So just recognizing that even the Federal Reserve is being real candid here and is telling us there's a process involved here, but they are speaking directly to the actual increasing of the money supply. And we've talked about that we're hitting on the word inflation and how the definition of inflation, you know, has somehow been really confused in a sense. The rising of price is really the effect of the actual process of inflation. And so if you remember, we were talking in the last episode that Caesar would get at the end of the year and had all these bills to pay and really just did not have, you know, enough money to do it with. And so if you just stop and consider the situation that happens in our country today, I mean, we get to the end of every year and government has collected all the taxes from everybody, but they always have more bills than money. So how is it that government today comes up with the money to pay for all of these bills? Because it has an astronomical amount of bills to pay. You know, we too have a very powerful military like Caesar, and the cost to maintain it is astronomical. Plus, we have all these government programs. So we have a lot of bills to pay, and we never have enough money. And so the question comes up again, how is it that our government comes up with the extra money to pay for all of this? And this is really what we're trying to explain right now in this particular podcast.
Okay, great, Carlos. Thanks for bringing everyone back up to speed, and you raised some good points there. So the big picture of what we're trying to do now in this particular episode, folks, is we're going to say clearly the specific mechanism by which the political rulers inflate the money and thus push up prices, and that's the mechanism by which they get to spend more than they could if they relied merely on direct taxation or even just borrowing of existing money out there. The way they do it nowadays is not exactly the same as Caesar did it, right? Because we don't have gold coins or silver coins circulating that they can take and then melt down and add in a baser metal. That's not the way they do it, because right now the coins barely have any precious metals in them at all. So that's clearly not the mechanism, but yet there is something analogous, and it's just, but it's a lot easier if we started with the Caesar example so you can see it quite clearly what's going on and then update it to our times where it's harder to see exactly what the scam is, if you will, or where the rabbit gets put into the hat, if you want to think of it in terms of a magic trick. Now, Carlos also raised, quoting from that Federal Reserve report, there's two separate mechanisms nowadays by which the quantity of, let's just keep talking about the United States, the quantity of dollars in the hands of the public increases. One of them is from the central bank, where the central bank, this is what we're going to talk about, does certain operations, and then another mechanism is, given the central bank's doing that thing over there, now the commercial banks, you know, the private sector banks that you go into and you take loans out and so forth, they also play a role in this in creating more dollars, all right? We decided, in the interest of brevity and so as not to lose too many of you in the format of an audio podcast, we are not going to tackle the issue of how commercial banks increase the quantity of dollars in the United States, even though that's a tremendously important thing for you to understand, and it has to do with what's called fractional reserve banking. If you want to know more about that, we literally wrote a book on it, folks, How Privatized Banking Really Works. That's a big part of what I think we do in that book, is explain in terms the average reader can understand just how it is that commercial banks, the way they operate nowadays with the institutional and regulatory framework, how they, in a very real sense, create new money in the course of what they do. And so it's important for you to understand that. But again, that's tricky for us to get across in a conversational format. So go to laramurphy.com and go look up our book, How Privatized Banking Really Works, if you want to see that explanation. Hey, so Bob, what are we going to – sorry, Carlos, go ahead.
Well, I just thought of something, again, so that people don't get lost here. We sort of all know there's been an enormous amount of money created, obviously. But you have to use your imagination here, in that it's not like all of a sudden the economy is flooded with paper dollar bills. You know, truly what the publication, the Federal Reserve publication, is saying is that it's done through credit. So, and credit, you know, flows through the commercial banking system when they grant loans and issue loans, you see. So it's the money supply is increased through credit, the expansion of credit. So I just want to make that distinction, because at first I stumbled on, well, does that mean that our whole economy all of a sudden is flooded with paper dollar bills everywhere? You know, like we're walking around with wheelbarrows trying to carry it all. But it's the expansion of credit. That's the modern version of the expansion of the money supply.
Okay, yeah, great. And I'm glad you're there to chime in if I'm saying something or if I'm leaving something out that we want to make sure our listeners don't get left behind. So yes, that's one difference between what was going on in the story we told about Caesar versus today. Is, you might have thought, oh, one difference is, or the only difference is, that instead of using coins that have gold and silver in them, now we use green pieces of paper and coins that don't have a bunch of precious metals in them, that are baser metals. Well, that is true, but as Carlos is saying, a lot of what happens now in commerce, you do just by the transfer of electronic deposits, right? When you just swipe your card to pay for something, it's not that you actually pull out and you turn over green pieces of paper or coins to make all your purchases that are denominated in U.S. dollars. So that is an insight into what's going on. Again, to fully understand it, I push you towards our book. But for the purposes of this podcast, the remaining time we have, let's focus just on the role that the central bank plays. So in the United States, the central bank is the Federal Reserve. So the key thing to understand here is that when the Fed buys assets, where does it get the money to do that, right? So the Federal Reserve comes into the marketplace and maybe it buys bonds from some secondary dealer, right? It buys $1 million worth of treasuries. You know, so a treasury is a security issued by the U.S. Treasury, right? So it's like a bond that Uncle Sam issues in order to partly cover the budget deficit for a given year. So people in the private sector lend money to Uncle Sam, to the Treasury, by buying a bond, and then they can sell that in turn to the Federal Reserve. So now the question is, if the Federal Reserve decides to buy $1 million worth of Treasury bonds from a dealer in the public, where does the Fed get that money? Is it that Ben Bernanke or Janet Yellen have been out cutting lawns all summer and they've saved up $1 million in the bank? No, of course that's not what happens. This may sound shocking to you. You might think I'm simplifying, but I'm not. Literally what happens is, in the very act of the Federal Reserve buying an asset from some seller, it just electronically writes a check and gives credits, reserves, to that person. And when that person, the seller, then goes and deposits that check with his or her regular bank, now all of a sudden that regular commercial bank sees its balance with the Fed go up by $1 million. Okay, so when you say where'd the $1 million come from, it didn't come from anywhere. The Fed just created it, added it to the system. So now if you count it up and said how many total dollars are in the banking system by adding up everybody's balances, that number would have gone up by $1 million just by the Fed buying those $1 million worth of bonds. All right, so I'll stop there. Carlos, do you want to maybe talk about that in your own words to make sure the listeners get what I just said?
So what I'll do is just maybe back up and bring it forward to what you just said. So again, don't lose the imagery of Caesar and what he is doing 2,000 years ago, and look at it as to how it happens today. So again, the government needs more money to pay the bills. Okay, so how do they get the money? Well, they're going to actually issue, the Treasury Department is actually going to issue a bond, okay, an IOU, which the government is willing to pay interest on, you know, during the year, and then at some future point in time is going to pay the principal on it. Now, when the Treasury issues those bonds, it's borrowing money at that point. So when we answer the question, how does the government come up with the extra money beyond the taxes that it collected, it's going to borrow the money in order to pay those bills. And it's going to issue a treasury, a bond, and put it out in the marketplace for individuals to buy, institutions to buy, and even countries to buy. It's going to, if one of those three parties buys those bonds, the government is going to pay them interest on that bond. And then at the future date, when that bond matures, it's going to pay the principal back. What Bob is saying is one of the principal buyers of those bonds is the Federal Reserve. So you can imagine the Federal Reserve in its most simplistic form, literally printing up the dollar bills, which it's not really doing, but you can say, people even say they're printing money, and literally giving it to the government so that it can pay its bills. So that's a very direct way of getting you to where Bob took you. But what Bob has said is the Federal Reserve does not do it that directly. It will buy the bonds out in the open market, all right? And then he went on to say he bought $1 million in the open market from, say, some Wall Street bond dealer. And then he went on to say, well, where does the Federal Reserve, you know, how does the Federal Reserve pay for that $1 million bond? How does he do it? Because they don't have any money. They don't have a checking account. Well, Bob says they literally just write a check on themselves, you know, and it's not going to bounce. And so gives it to the bond dealer. And now the bond dealer has got a check from the Federal Reserve for $1 million. Well, what can that bond dealer do with that check? Well, he can only do the same thing that we would do if we got a check from the Federal Reserve. We go to our bank and we deposit that check. So as you see, what Bob is saying, from the get-go, the Federal Reserve has created $1 million, almost literally out of thin air, but it wound up into the commercial bank. And then Bob went on to explain that the commercial bank's numbers, you know, tabulations on that $1 million coming in go up. And but you see the connection between the Federal Reserve to the bond dealer in the form of a check coming into the commercial banking system.
Great. Thanks for clarifying there, Carlos. And you're right. Probably the intermediate step, going from what Caesar was doing to what the Fed is doing in practice in the government right now, an intermediate step would be, just imagine, as you said, Carlos, that the Federal Reserve is literally printing $100 bills off. And then the government says, whoa, we have a $1 trillion deficit this year, right? We want to spend $4 trillion. We've only got $3 trillion in taxes. We're $1 trillion short. What do we do? And imagine the Fed just literally printed $1 trillion in green pieces of paper and handed them over to the United States government. And then the government went into the markets and bought that extra $1 trillion worth of stuff with this newly printed money. You could see the obvious connection between that and what Caesar was doing. Right. And then there'd be extra dollar bills floating around. Clearly, prices quoted in dollars would rise, and you would realize, oh, wait a minute. The way the government is making up that $1 trillion deficit is by taxing everybody through inflation, right? That people are seeing prices rise, stuff is coming more expensive, and they don't have more dollars in the beginning. And so they're worse off, and that's how the government is ultimately paying for that $1 trillion budget deficit through inflation. Because that would be crystal clear, and that's why it's not legal for the government to do that, right? If they did do that right now, they would be violating some sort of regulation or statute, and the financial press would go nuts. They'd say, whoa, you're monetizing the debt. That's crazy. That's like what Zimbabwe did. Okay, so they're more clever. They're more subtle about it. What they do is, when the Treasury has a deficit, right, when they want to spend more than they take in, they don't just say, hey, print up money and give it to us. Instead, they said, no, we're going to be like good stewards of our resources, and we're going to be like any other corporation. We're going to issue bonds and borrow the money from the public. And so if they have a $1 trillion deficit, they issue $1 trillion in new bonds, treasury securities, and that's where they get the money from. So that money was already in the hands of the public, and the government just sells the bonds, issues the bonds to the public. The public turns over the previously existing dollars, and there you go. So the government borrowing per se is not inflationary. Just like if GM wants to build a new factory and issues bonds, that doesn't create more dollar bills in the economy, right? So the Treasury, just by borrowing per se, that operation by itself does not make more dollars. But the problem is, or the trick, is that the Federal Reserve, if it wants to expand its balance sheet, what does it typically buy? It buys government bonds. And so when the Fed now comes into the marketplace, and if it, let's just say, it does the whole thing. Imagine the Fed prints up, or you know, literally prints $1 trillion, or does it electronically, is in practice how they do it, and buys those $1 trillion of extra government debt off the hands of the public and pulls it onto the Fed's balance sheet. What happens? Now the public is holding $1 trillion in new money that the Fed just created out of thin air, and now the bonds have been moved onto the asset side of the Fed's balance sheet. So it's kind of a big shell game, but in practice, when the dust settles, if you sit back and look at what happened, there's an extra $1 trillion that the Fed created, and the $1 trillion in new debt that Uncle Sam issued is sitting on the books of the Federal Reserve. So in practice, it's very similar to if the Fed had literally just printed up $1 trillion in new green pieces of paper, given them to the Treasury, and said, this is the way you cover your shortfall, and there was no, you know, the public wasn't involved at all. But in practice, again, what they do is, it's a shell game where the Treasury technically issues more bonds, and that's how they directly get the money to spend. But then the public doesn't just hold those treasuries. It sells the treasuries to the Fed in exchange for new dollars. So the public ends up with more dollars in circulation, and that new debt that the government issued ends up on the books of the Fed. And that's – so it's a shell game. All right. So that – we're leaving out a lot of stuff, but that is the basic mechanism, to the extent to which in any given year the new debt issued by Uncle Sam ends up on the books of the Fed. You can kind of say that's the percentage of the debt that has been monetized. And there were periods recently where that was a pretty high percentage. where the Fed was adding so much to its balance sheet that it was a pretty high percentage of the new debt that was being issued by the government in that time period. And so there was a sense in which you could say that was X percent, you know, monetization of the debt, something that when Zimbabwe does it, we all recognize as being completely irresponsible. And, oh, yeah, they're just running the printing presses to pay for the government's profligacy. But yet when it's the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury, people get real huffy and, you know, severe about it. Oh, yes, and this is quite necessary for quantitative easing and da-da-da-da-da, when many of us are more cynical and think the reason the Fed was engaging in all those bouts of quantitative easing, so-called, was because the Obama administration was running trillion-dollar-plus budget deficits. Okay, so now, Carlos, I know me talking about that is going to raise a question in the minds of some listeners, so do you want to address that, you know, that certain worry or confusion?
Well, a couple of things come to mind. First of all, you know, it's important to realize, where did this idea come from to start with? You know, the idea that you could run deficits this way. You know, keep in mind that, and we've said this in previous episodes, is that all this got started with John Maynard Keynes introducing, I guess we would call it, modern economics back in 1936 in the middle of the Great Depression. You see, everything had come to a screeching halt, not just in the United States, worldwide. And so the idea that Maynard Keynes came up with is, no, what we've got to do is create jobs. So let's have the government buy things, buy assets, anything, you know, just go out and create paychecks. Because, as I said, Keynesian economics more or less thinks that the whole motor of the economy is spending, you see. So this was a long time ago that this modern economics, you know, came into play here. And so it's very much in our system. You know, the Federal Reserve system has been in place for over 100 years, see, and in other countries longer than that. So this whole mechanism is very much a part of how this money supply, you know, is increased. So what we see is that the Federal Reserve, you know, buying assets in the open market, and you have to see that because the buying of those assets, the money eventually comes into commercial banks. Commercial banks then expand credit, okay? And so it's through the issuing of loans that we see this expansion of credit going out. Now, it's a very mysterious process. It's complicated. I'm not sure if we did it full justice here, but again, Robert keeps pointing you back to our book where we can really spell it out in step-by-step detail so you can really grasp this process. But you don't notice something, Bob. You notice that in the presidential elections, that's not even brought up. You know, the Federal Reserve and you know what it does in the economy, and yet you know we do address the national debt, you know, and so a lot of the problems that we have, you know, just in our economy. But it's important to recognize where all this stems from. It's actually the workings of the central bank.
Yeah, that's a great point, Carlos. I mean, obviously, the one political candidate in recent memory who did put the Fed on the table was Ron Paul. And I've said this before, I actually, it just shows why he's a better politician than I was. That when he was running and bringing up the Fed, I thought, no, nobody cares about the Fed. It's so boring and it's so hard and technical. Just talk about getting the troops home or talk about legalizing drugs if you're going to be on a college campus. That's the kid. And no, he was talking about the Federal Reserve and such. The college kids were chanting, end the Fed. I was astonished. And so you do see some remnants of that in that some people will talk about the Fed. But you're right, Carlos, they don't. It's clear that nowadays the candidates mentioning it, they're just doing that, you know, waving red meat in front of some of their Tea Party fans or something who might know that there's a problem with the Fed. They really don't understand the mechanics of it, and the average person also, unfortunately, doesn't. And I think that's by design. They don't like the public to realize what's going on. That's partly why they make it so complicated and mysterious. And that, folks, is what we're trying to do here at the Laura Murphy Show. And of course, if you go to our website, lauramurphy.com, you can read more about all this stuff. And if you really want to know how the Federal Reserve works, how the commercial banking system works, where these new dollars come from, because that's the solution to all this, that the new dollars are ultimately coming from the Federal Reserve going through the commercial banking system, and that's why prices rise year over year. That's why, you know, your grandfather says, I can remember when you go to McDonald's and a hamburger only costs such and such, right? Why is it that prices keep rising inexorably? Well, it's because new dollars keep coming into the system. And in this episode here, we've just given you a taste of how that happens. And so you can see when the government nowadays has a budget deficit, it issues bonds. The Fed ultimately soaks up some of that debt by creating new dollars, and it pushes up prices. So you see, it's the same basic mechanism as what Caesar was doing. It's just a lot more complicated to see what's going on. So that's all the time we have for this week's episode. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. As always, please share this podcast with your friends, relatives, acquaintances, even your mortal enemy, because your mortal enemy needs to know how the Fed works too. I am Robert Murphy, Carlos Lara, and this is the Lara Murphy Show, and we will see you guys next time.
You've just finished another episode of the Lara Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Lara Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LaraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.